If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today's episode was kind of inspired by an article that you read in The Economist magazine with the headline, "Hospitals are stuck in a deadly doom loop. They never recovered from COVID-19. What's the kind of thesis of this piece and why did it grab your attention?
Yeah, well, here in the UK, of course, we're very well aware of the problems that the National Health Service, the government states, Health Service is struggling with very long waiting lists and a sense of being completely overloaded, long delays in A&E departments, and also very high levels of staff burnout and disillusionment and so on. And it's easy for us Brits to imagine that this is just a fairly unique British phenomenon. And what really struck me about this article in The Economist was that, in fact, this is a phenomenon across pretty well all richer countries in the world, that there can be seen a very significant decline in the quality of care with the problems that hospitals are facing. And in every case, it seems to the decline started around 2020, at the time of the pandemic. And I think this seems to be a really important message, because here we are 6 years later, and at one level it's really hard to believe that, yes, COVID was a horrible reality for all of us, but is it really having that kind of effect 6 years on? Why should that be?
And I think we'll get into in a moment some of the reasons why, but there's this really striking chart that The Economist article has, which we'll link in the show notes of this episode, which has looked at 14 European countries and then other Western states like Australia, Canada, United States, New Zealand, and has looked at satisfaction with the availability of healthcare. And for about 15 years leading up to 2020, that line is basically flat. And obviously within that is huge variety. You know, some country satisfaction is down at 50%, some of it's up in the high 90s, but the average across these OECD, these rich countries, is about 80%. And then at the point of 2020, when the COVID pandemic hits, in every single country, the number goes down. And the average is now declined. By 2025, it's declined down to the 60s. So quite a significant deterioration in how, I guess, consumers of healthcare, citizens, are feeling. And as you say, what is so striking about this is that it's not just very kind of cash-strapped public systems like we have in the UK, but it's also the almost entirely private and very wealthy system they have in the United States. And then it's also these more mixed insurance systems that are common on the continent. It's places as far afield as New Zealand and Australia. Something very significant happened to these completely different healthcare systems in the pandemic that has left them really struggling even 6 years on.
Yeah, and just one statistic, that waits for hip replacements are above pre-pandemic levels in 9 out of 11 OECD countries. That's the rich countries. Canada is perhaps the worst hit. And so this phenomenon is a very real phenomenon. And the article goes on to trace the likely explanation, which is a very complicated set of vicious circles of things, negative consequences, which then spiral and feed off each other.
And the other thing that really struck me reading this was that we often assume that healthcare systems are a bit like any public service. You know, the output you get is basically dependent on how much money you input into the system. But actually, this economist writer finds that funding for the healthcare is the highest it's ever been. You know, spending in the OECD rose to nearly 10% of GDP following the pandemic. In Europe alone, it's risen 13% since 2019. So, there are more doctors, there are more nurses, there are more pounds and dollars and euros going into these health systems, and yet somehow what we're getting less out of them, or poorer outcomes out of them, which is just absolutely perplexing.
Absolutely. And you know, it's something that I've frequently thought about, and it's not just the pandemic, but you know, when I, in those dim and distant passes, when I was working as a junior doctor, I mean, looking back, our lifestyles were ridiculous. In terms of the hours, I was literally working 70, 80, 90 hours a week for years on end. And yet, despite all that, and we all complained about the hours and it was all terrible and all the rest, actually, morale was pretty high. And now, you know, doctors and health professionals have never been better paid. And in many ways, in terms of hours work, the hours have never been as short, and yet morale is absolutely rock bottom. And so it is a very interesting phenomenon. But clearly, COVID has had a continuing impact, and not just on health services. We'll also, I think, just briefly think about other public services as well. But it's worth just thinking a bit about, just very briefly, about the medical reasons. And it seems to be, the main thing seems to be that you get into a vicious loop whereby, because waiting lists are extending, people get sicker and sicker while they're on the waiting list. Therefore, they do worse, they have more complications. Once they actually get the treatment, once they get into hospital, because they're sicker, because they have more complications, they then spend longer time in hospital, which means that other people off the waiting list can't come in off the waiting list, and the waiting list extends further, and so it goes on. And at the same time, because the staff are under this constant pressure, you know, bed occupancy is over 100% you know, effectively, and they're constantly feeling this pressure and the waiting lists. And I remember as a doctor how frustrating it was, this feeling that the demand is just endless. However hard you work, you're never going to get on top of it. So morale gets lowered down, people go off sick, so there's more health professionals go off sick, that means staffing levels go down, that means waiting lists go longer, and so these vicious doom loops, as the economist put it, carry on.
Yes. And all this in the context where in Western nations, as we know, populations are getting older as people live longer and have fewer children, and older people tend to have more complex chronic illnesses. And so you have fewer patients who are kind of in and out in a day. It's a quick fix, put the arm in a splint and move on. And you have more patients every year in these kind of aging, declining Western countries who need lengthy hospital stays because they have overlapping chronic conditions that can only really be partially managed. And so even without the shock of COVID, the health systems were already kind of buckling under the strain. And then it seems like this crisis in 2020, 2021 has sent things into free fall, and no matter how much extra resources governments are trying to pump into their healthcare systems, they're not really able to ever catch up.
I think another factor which I remember we talked about this at the time, in the original time of the first COVID pandemic, and that was the reason why the politicians in the UK put such a stress on trying to protect the NHS was because there are so many people with chronic illnesses who are utterly dependent on regular, weekly, monthly care from the NHS just to keep going. And that if the NHS falls apart, and therefore, you know, all those people with diabetes, all those people with asthma, all those people with chronic mental health conditions, all those people with cancer, everybody with these sort of chronic conditions are going to suffer. And that has huge knock-on effects for the economy, for society as a whole.
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the messaging in this country during the pandemic was a slightly different to some other countries, in which we were all kind of told, stay at home, save lives, but also the third leg of that was protect the NHS. And the public messaging from the government was very much that what is absolutely vital is that we don't overload our NHS system, and that we keep beds free for COVID patients who are sick, so that we don't have, you know, the kind of ghastly spectre of rationing, of running out of critical care beds, of ventilators, and having people gasping to death on the streets outside major hospitals because there's literally no room. And by and large, that was secured, and the NHS just about by its fingertips didn't completely keel over, despite the onslaught of the people with this new novel respiratory virus arriving on their doorsteps. But what it seems is that we may have protected the NHS for those critical 6, 12, 18 months until we got vaccines in our arms and life came back to normal. But we actually did some lasting slow burn damage to the system, which we're still reaping the consequences of today.
Yes, except to say that, as this article shows, it's not just an NHS phenomenon.
No.
I think this phenomenon is a very widespread, affects nearly all well-developed health systems, which is remarkable. And it's just a reminder of, however much we would like to pretend that COVID just came and went and life gone on as normal, that is just not the case.
No.
That it has huge long-term consequences. There are people with long COVID who are still severely debilitated and disabled 3, 4, 5 years later. But also there are acute cases, people becoming infected, new infections, and becoming sick. So however much you want to pretend, it hasn't gone away, but it's also dealt a sort of body blow to fundamental public services. And it's not just hospitals. I mean, it's well known in the UK that our legal system appears to be as broken as our health system.
Yes, you're right. There's been it was already struggling after a lot of cuts to the legal system during the austerity period in the 2010s. But certainly the backlog of cases that are waiting to be tried in English courts is at all-time record highs. I think it's over 40,000 cases in the queue waiting for a date. And so serious has that kind of problem become. You know, people are being charged with an offence and say, could you come back in 2032 for us to put that before a jury and see if you're actually guilty or not?
Or they might be in prison, mightn't they? They might be in a remand prison waiting.
Sometimes they might be in remand. I think they try and prioritise those ones a little bit more. But also, if you're the victim of a crime, it's clearly, you know, as the old phrase goes, justice delayed is justice denied. To report a crime to the police, they do an investigation, they charge someone with an offence, but then say, we're not actually going to find out if this person is guilty, let alone offer any punishment to them for 4 or 5 years. I mean, it's unconscionable. And so actually there's some quite radical things being proposed in the UK, including the partial kind of abolition of the jury trial, a tradition that dates back over 1,000 years, you know, is mentioned in Magna Carta in an effort to try and speed up cases, because it can be heard more quickly if it's just a judge or a series of judges rather than a jury of your peers.
Yeah, and there was another example, perhaps not quite so life-threatening, you mentioned about driving tests.
Yes, that's another silly, kind of not silly example. I mean, for some people it can be very serious, you know, but the system of booking your driving test in England, I don't know if it's the same across the UK, you do it through a government website. There are test centres across the country, and before times, you would take some lessons and then you would book a test a few months in advance and turn up and do your test and hopefully get your licence. But the system basically completely fell over because they cancelled all tests for a period of time during the COVID lockdowns. And obviously people carried on turning 18 and wanting to learn to drive, and that built up. And then when they resumed a year later, there was this pent-up demand that completely overwhelmed the system. And they've, even 5 years on, it's been very difficult to kind of make any headway in that. So my understanding is even today, it's extremely difficult to find any spare slots in the entire country, let alone at your local testing centre. You know, people are resorting to booking on in the Hebrides and up out of Scotland or something, and then hoping that nearer the time they can shift that test to a centre that's actually, you know, within driving distance of their home, which is clearly, you know, not an ideal situation. So, and there's been similar issues, backlogs around applying for passports or other government services that basically shut down overnight, and yet when they've resumed, haven't had anything like the resources to get them back to the kind of level of productivity or efficiency that they were pre-COVID.
So it does seem a very real phenomenon, and I was had the privilege of taking part in a invitation-only workshop a few weeks ago, discussing in private how the church responded to the COVID pandemic, and discussing, you know, about the fact of future pandemics. You know, what can we learn? What went well? What didn't go well? What can we learn from the past experiences in order to prepare for the next one? At the time, we were all preparing, that those in public health and in the medical world were preparing for pandemic influenza, which is an extremely dangerous and devastating condition when it's severe. And in fact, it goes back to that original influenza outbreak at the end of the First World War in 1918-1919, which led
Spanish
to
flu, it's often known Spanish as, flu. Yeah.
And the experts say that is still a significant risk. Sooner or later, there's going to be another massive influenza pandemic like that. So preparing for the next pandemic is really important. But if something like COVID can have such a devastating effect 6 years on, you know, how likely are we going to be able to cope with the next one?
Yeah, exactly. And there was a lot of discussion in this country of how the kind of state had been hollowed out through things like austerity and had very limited capacity and resilience to cope with these unexpected kind of geopolitical shocks from beyond the borders. You know, no one in British politics planned for or decided that we were going to have to suddenly go into a lockdown, in the same way that no one in the British state planned for or decided that we would have a huge surge in energy costs after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or an oil blockade as we're currently experiencing in the Straits of Hormuz. It feels like the complacency and the stability of the Western world has been repeatedly upended by these sudden international emergencies and crises, and that they're all revealing is that what we thought is quite a sophisticated, resilient, developed system of government and politics and economics is actually much more fragile than we might have thought.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it's a recurring theme that public services and trust in public services seems to be steadily declining, not just in the UK, but of course we can see the same phenomenon in the States, we can see that in other countries.
Yeah.
And I was just reflecting that whereas I think in previous generations the idea of doing public service was seen as a very high calling, you know, I am a servant of the public, and I am doing my best for the good of the community, and I'm respected in my role because of, you know, as a public servant. Whether, you know, the impact of economic changes, neoliberalism, you know, all that kind of stuff. It says, you know what, it's the private sector. That's where the growth is. That's where the greatest, the best and the brightest should go. The entrepreneurs, the people who break the mold. Mm. And public service, oh, that's very second rate, ho hum. You know, if you can't do any better, you could at least go into the public service. Do you think there's something in that there's a change in attitudes?
Possibly. Yeah, I think certainly maybe the kind of allure or the sense of the status of public service is diminished for maybe some of our elite. I think the other thing I would add to that conversation is certainly I think my generation, people in their 30s and below, do feel like we've kind of, since we came into adulthood, we've just lived through like rolling crises. You know, we came of age during the great financial crash, and then we had the kind of wave of Islamic terrorism in the early 2010s, the Brexit election referendum, Donald Trump, COVID, the Ukraine war. I think there's a sense in which Western governments are seen as kind of sclerotic and gridlocked, dominated by baby boomers who are just kind of feathering their own nests.
It's my generation, is it, that is possibly ultimately to hell with all this.
But I think there is a sense that like the energy and the dynamism and the vigor is found in, you know, tech startups or China or something like that. And the idea that, you know, the UK civil service or going to work for your congressman in the States as some kind of noble venture. People have lost faith that the state has the levers to pull to actually make things better for you in ordinary life. They feel like the state is kind of stumbling along, reacting from crisis to crisis. And the people who are really building things and bursting forward to make for the new century are, you know, Elon Musk and SpaceX.
Yeah.
Or something like that. You know, it's the private sector that is at the frontier that is going to make the future. Whereas I think in a previous era, you had a much greater sense of optimism about what the state could achieve.
But it's incredibly short-sighted, isn't it? Because, you know, entrepreneurs are not going to provide public security service. They're not going to provide legal system. They're not going to provide, well, they might provide some healthcare if Brian, you can afford it. They're not going to make sure that the traffic system works well and that people get properly tested and so on and so on and so on. You know, that actually there's a sense in which they're parasites on the state. They just take for granted that all that is in play so they can go and earn their billions and play games. And I mean, that's a caricature, isn't it? But I think that just because public service is not seen as very sexy and very life-changing, I think that's a real threat to society, because it historically it has always depended on being able to attract people of real commitment and caliber and ability into these roles.
Yes, I think that's certainly true.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premiere Unbelievable.
I wonder if another part of the puzzle is a sense in which that we've slightly lost sight of the kind of common good and the idea that part of my responsibility as a human being is not just to look out for my own needs, but to kind of build a thriving system that works for everyone. And the state is a kind of ultimate expression of that kind of investment in the common good. I'm going to go and devote my life working in some arcane area of regulation or something like that in the bureaucracy, so that, you know, the trains run on time for millions of other people. And I wonder if in our kind of hyper-individualized age, in which people are kind of encouraged from quite a young age to see life as a race in which they need to make sure they finish first. And that kind of expressive individualism we've talked about before is the kind of zeitgeist of the age. You have to find out what really matters to you and then like pursue that at all costs. That's the highest calling on a human being. That cuts across this idea of public service and the common good. And it's easier to say, yeah, I'm going to become an influencer. I'm going to be a startup founder. I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I'm going to build something myself and then, you know, sit back and count my millions. Taps into that yearning and longing that I think is inculcated in people from quite a young age in our 21st century late capitalism.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. And it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I remember hearing a talk pointing out that the whole understanding of public service is actually very closely related to a Christian understanding of service. Mm. It's sort of actually deliberately taking a lowly role. I mean, it's one of the honourable traditions in the UK that, for instance, the Prime Minister is paid, you know, relatively poorly, you know, the salary of a sort of low-grade executive in a medium-sized company is what, you know, our Prime Minister gets. You know, why on earth is that? Answer, because he's a public servant. He's not there in order to preen himself with the biggest salary. And, yes. And even calling us, the most senior politicians are called secretaries. They're secretaries of state, you know, because it's a service secretarial role to ensure that the state functions properly.
Yeah. There's this idea of you're there to facilitate. I mean, even, you know, we call them civil servants, right? And these sometimes are people who manage budgets in the tens of billions. And they might have under them a department of 100,000 workers, but they are a civil servant. They serve the civitas, the city, the commune, the citizens, the collective. And I think there was a period when the kind of modern state emerged in the kind of latter half of the 1800s, when that was kind of valorized and held as an honorable profession, and it was kind of seen as good for people of high means or ability to set aside the money they could make in the private sector and instead devote themselves to public service. I don't know if that's changing. I mean, there's no shortage of people queuing up to be MPs, for instance, despite many of them probably being able to earn more money if they went into consultancy or law or business, finance. I mean, you know, consultant doctors make more money than MPs. You know, there's lots of professions that will out-earn the Prime Minister, and yet we don't seem to have any shortage of people lining up to take that job or to desire that job. So I don't know if it's people have entirely lost touch with the idea that there is value in setting aside personal enrichment for public service.
Yes, I suppose just coming into land, thinking about from a Christian response to all this, it's quite hard, isn't it, to think, how does this relate to our Christian understanding, first of all, of what it means to be human, of what it means to live in a community, mm-hmm. what it means, you know, we're resident aliens, we don't necessarily belong here from a Christian point of view, but we're to seek the good of the city whilst we're here.
I guess that we need to maybe reimagine or kind of go back to what is our theology of the state. You know, Christians, well, at least most mainstream churches don't believe in a kind of separatism where Christians are supposed to kind of wall themselves off from the rest of society and build their own parallel institutions in an enclave. So if states are fundamentally like avenues in which Christians can serve, what is our theology of that? You know, like I said, talking about the concept of the common good. You know, why does God want people to go and work in the Department for Farming and Rural Affairs handling fertilizer regulation? You know, how does that serve God's purposes and God's kingdom? Why is that as valuable as being a full-time evangelist or a church minister or a worship pastor or anything else that seems more closely attached to building, to kind of serving God's purposes to make all things new? I wonder if the church needs to take a step back and first figure out how can we recapture people with the idea that you can take your the God-given talents and serve God by being a cog in the bureaucracy, in the machine, trying to rebuild some of the capacity that's been hollowed out by these kind of rolling crises that we've experienced in the last few years, and kind of give people a vision to get excited by. This is a wonderful way to serve, while acknowledging that there's always going to be those grey, complex areas, because you're not working in a theocracy, you're working in a, in particularly in the West, you know, increasingly secularized states whose interests may not always be aligned with God's.
Yeah, but and I can't help feeling that this constant focus on, you know, the individuals who stand out, the influencers, the entrepreneurs, the unicorns, you know, the sports celebs, film stars, it's deeply unhealthy that we cannot celebrate the people who are not known because they are serving the common good, because they're there for others, not wishing to draw attention to themselves.
I mean, didn't we mention in a recent episode that kind of idea, I think that came out of the Reformation, it might even have been a quote from Luther, about this idea that, you know, that the housewife, as she sweeps the dust out of her kitchen, kind of serves God just as much as the greatest archbishop, you know, reciting his liturgy in some cathedral. And that there was a strong strain of the Protestant Reformation, which was about kind of recapturing and valorizing the ordinary faithfulness of everyday lay life. You know, you don't have to be a priest or an archbishop or a pope to be of value to God's kingdom and God's church. And you don't even have to ostensibly be working in a Christian enterprise, but actually there is huge value in that kind of ordinary faithfulness. And I think that includes, you know, going to work for your local council or municipality and just saying, I'm going to devote my time and my energies and my efforts to making my community work a little bit better.
Yeah, and actually we both know many people who are doing exactly that, don't they? We know many Christian people who feel that their vocation is in helping the trains run on time in London, in teaching, in doing unsung heroic jobs in the health service, and in social services, and in the legal profession, and politics, and so on. So it's not as though there aren't many people doing this.
Of course.
I think what we there is a need just to try to help people see that this is an honourable way to live, a worthwhile, in fact, a far better way to live than many of the celebrity professions which are being promoted.
I do sometimes worry that parts of the church have got somewhat captured by our society's obsession with celebrity and with leadership and with kind of charismatic individuals. You know, there are certain elements of the church that make a big play about being leaders, about being influential in your field. And I think this is partly a consequence of, you know, having churches that are stuffed full of middle-class professionals rather than bus drivers and Tesco checkout workers and all the other people who make up a society, but sadly are much less likely to come to church in the 21st century. But I think it's also slightly theologically problematic or questionable. Does God call everyone to be superb in their professional endeavours? I think God is interested in us working hard and doing our best, but I don't think God minds if you're a middle manager. I think, you know, what the teaching you can draw out from Paul is about more about character and integrity in the workplace. It's about, are you treating your employees and your employer with as though they were Christ himself? Are you treating the people you engage with as ends, not means? And whether you you know, nail those promotions and become run the company in one day, or become an incredibly like famous individual, I think is unimportant in God's economy.
Well, and indeed, there are, you know, many statements like the first shall be last and the last shall be first, you know, aren't there? I mean, you know, isn't it a theme throughout Scripture that, you know, it's, you know, all those brothers line up and then where's the littlest one? Oh, David, oh, he doesn't count. He's just somewhere out looking after the sheep, you know, and yet he's God's man. And so on it goes, doesn't it? So I think we should beware this celebrity culture. Interestingly, I've often thought that goes back to the Greek, particularly the whole thing about the Olympics and the athletics, which prizes this heroic, you know, masculine and dominant individual who is the best of the best and is then celebrated. And that whole incredibly competitive ethos seems to be turned on its head by Christianity, which says exactly the opposite.
And if I could be just a smidge provocative, I would also raise the question of, has the Western, certainly the English-speaking church, is so dominated by the culture that comes out of the United States? We read their books and their conference, go to their conferences and sing their songs and listen to their preachers. And I think the America is such a profoundly capitalistic state. And I'm not an anti-capitalist by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it has been so, that culture is so saturated in that kind of, you know, I mean, what is the American dream, right? It's this idea that any little person can arrive on a boat and work their way up to be president or to be a captain of industry. Mm-hmm. It's about that kind of heroic individualism, the frontier spirit, the pioneers. They have always been reified in American culture. And I think the American church has absorbed some of that quite uncritically and created the very concept of the Christian celebrity. And then everyone who's downstream of the American church has to be wary of, as we consume their Christian culture and media and resources, are we also consuming some of that hyper-capitalistic obsession with individual development, growth, and heroism in a Christian context?
And it just occurs to me that the polar opposite of that, I suspect, is what's happening in China with the Christian church there. You know, is that by all accounts, there are extraordinary numbers, tens of millions of Christian believers, and yet one doesn't hear of these amazing celebrity preachers and dominant individuals. The whole Chinese culture ethos seems to be one that is much more emphasizing a kind of communitarian support for one another. I mean, just going back to COVID, one of the fascinating things, you know, is that the whole furore about masks, masks in Chinese culture, particularly, you know, because they'd had pre-COVID, they'd had these very serious pandemics.
SARS.
SARS and the other things, yeah. That's right. And they'd had devastating effects in particularly in Hong Kong and some other Chinese cities. But as a result, everybody started having protections, including wearing masks. But the whole point of a mask is that it had no protection for you. The reason that I had to wear a mask was to protect other people from myself, from me being infective. And so to go out without a mask was to risk huge social censor because you were being selfish. I mean, how dare you be selfish when everyone else is taking precautions? You know, once it comes to the UK and the USA, people are not the slightest bit interested about protecting other people. I want to know, does it stop? Does it help me? Is the evidence, it helps me? Yeah. So that's a little sort of image, isn't it, of how these different cultures. So maybe, you know, here's the thought. If Chinese Christianity continues to grow and have a an impact, at some stage, is it possible that it will have an impact globally in terms of maybe counteracting the unhelpful individualism that we see coming out of America?
Well, there's a question. I mean, I know, for instance, that there's been a kind of renewed kind of wave of persecution from the state in China, where they've been arresting some kind of well-known pastors and church figures. And one of the consequences of this is that a lot of the larger underground churches have had to kind of decentralize their model, because they can no longer gather thousands of people in a building in their town. And what a lot of them have done is basically kind of gone to a kind of cellular house group structure, where you break the church down to these small, single, two or three family groups who meet, and they log into Zoom to hear the sermon, but then basically do church in a very kind of early church style, you know, like Paul would be familiar with, based in homes around small numbers of people. And as you say, it's the very polar opposite of what has kind of become dominant in the West, which is that kind of mega church model where you pull everyone into one huge warehouse outside of town, surrounded by car parking spaces, to do these grander and grander spectacles. And maybe that's, again, some kind of healthy, obviously it's driven by persecution, but it's a healthy rebalancing to some of the unhealthy ways some of the Western church might have gone down, got some dead ends it might have got itself lost in.
Yeah, exactly the same happened in Eastern Europe at the time of the communist era and the persecution there, that churches tended to be meeting in secret and often broken down into small groups. You couldn't trust people that were informers and all the rest. But it was also striking is there were some outstanding church leaders that came out of the Eastern European persecution. But interestingly, they were outstanding because they suffered the most. I mean, these were the people who were tortured and imprisoned and sometimes put in solitary confinement for years on end. And they were celebrated. Richard Wurmbrand was one who had a huge impact on me as a young man. A pastor who spent many years being tortured and in a solitary confinement. So that's real leadership. It's not the celebrity preacher and worship leader. It's the person who demonstrates by their life and their commitment and their suffering that they deserve the title of leader.
Mm. Well, we've drifted quite a long way from the impact of COVID on healthcare systems, but I think we should probably wrap it up. We'd love to know your thoughts on some of the stuff we've been talking about today, both in terms of the kind of lingering effects of the pandemic on our public services and on the state capacity, and what could the church's response to some of those challenges be in the coming decades, but also on that broader question of whether we've lost sight of some of the common good and the value of kind of public service and the honour of public service in a hyper-individualised age. You can get in touch with us by emailing MOLAD, MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. Or you can find lots of other things to listen to, watch and to read on Dad's website, which is johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my own writing and journalism on my website, which is tswyatt.com. And I particularly encourage you, if you're interested in some of these things, to sign up for free to my weekly church news newsletter, which is called The Critical Friend. That's it for today. Thanks for watching, for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.